Chapter 13. Shivering. Night Owl. On a brisk morning, on a fertile island, quaintly secluded from much of the world most of the year by surrounding storms, a man addressed his family inside a home. His wife, strong and beautiful, was securing the plans for the rest of the day. The man, husband and father, was with their kids, the three of them. The night before had been stormy. Its winds woke two of the kids up and kept them awake in fear. The smallness of the island brought with it a sense of inadequate defense against nature, so small it could just be brushed away. The other child slept easier with a constant noise. This morning the weather was soothing and comfortable. The children were being prepared for the rest of the day, which would commence upon their mother's return. Two of the kids were too tired to be helpful, and the other too young to care or be of much practical utility to the situation. To ease their minds, the father spoke to them, mostly to pass time until the mother arrived, as she was better at dealing with uncooperative kids. The children all noticed the sense of worry on the father's face. He blamed himself for their needing to enact the plan of the day, though anyone else would call him the victim. The wife knew it wasn't his fault either. He knew she would never blame him, but the kids, he did not know. He told them a story to ease his own mind as much as theirs.
You kids know what one of the most efficient predators is, right?
This was meant to be as educational as it was entertaining.
Shark.
Wolf. Bear.
He let them all answer before he informed them. It mattered not the true efficiency of all predators. The exercise was a tool for the story, and it carried with it at least a partial truth.
The owl, which hunts at night, is an apex predator in most ecosystems.
Apex?
The youngest was the most interested in all matters even remotely relating to the field of environmental biology.
Means the top, best predator. You could even say the predator of all predators, though the owl was just the most formidable foe for the average wild animal.
The children were proven wrong, but were entranced.
At night, you won't see him coming. You won't be able to react before the owl strikes, and then it is too late. There is no fight. His competitors envy him, as he gets the best meals quicker and without struggle.
He continued,
but
making sure the children were still paying attention.
Some nights get very cold. Sometimes the feathers aren't enough.
There was a great pause as he reevaluated whether this story may do more harm than good.
Even the night owl gets cold. Shivering, it can be tough to say whether it shivers from cold or fear.
The apex.
The word struggled out as he made sure to pronounce it correctly.
Predator can get scared?
Sure. Just like anyone else. Everyone fears something stronger than them. Something they cannot fight against. The owl learned that there would always be a greater predator. The cold itself made it fear for safety. Do you know what the greatest predator to the owl was?
The children did not answer. For all they knew, up until now, the owl was the greatest predator.
Nature.
The kids looked as though they discovered a new way of life.
No matter what, nature is always more powerful. So don't worry about the wind or the waves. Even the night owl shivers at the thought of them. Yet, the owl still continues to be strong and efficient. You might even say that it is only because the owl has nothing else to worry about that nature seems so scary. It is the only thing left to worry about for the shivering night owl.
The father wasn't sure if he'd helped his kids, but he felt better. He placed himself in the position of the owl, as he hoped the children would too. He found himself struggling to stay on top of life, such was the climate of the place he resided. His job was taken from him, and now he must take his family from their home. The mother entered.
Come on, we need to catch the midday ferry.
The children gathered the remainder of their things in their barren house and wandered outside. The father waltzed to his wife for a quick kiss, the act a farewell to their first home.
Did you hear those loud noises earlier?
She did.
It seems like some people were playing with fireworks or something. At first I thought it was thunder, but the weather was too nice.
Whatever it was, it's someone else's problem now. Cowtip is going to just be a memory for us.
Memories,
she corrected.
Some good, some bad, but this will always be a special place.
The married couple left behind small remnants of life on the island as they headed to the ferry. Some of these remnants would go completely unnoticed, as if they never even lived here at all. Others would be indistinguishable from remnants of life after one's death. Footprints, odors, scraps, memories in someone else's life, scuffs on the wall and craters in the yard. With time, even these would fade, becoming background details in the stories of other people's lives. For them, the struggle would move to a new place. For others, the struggle would continue on the island. Candy writhed and struggled against this force holding her in place. Alexander fought himself thought for thought on how to keep her from making herself Cern's target, while not hurting her in the process as well. He wasn't oblivious to the fact that Shanaga was coming to her aid, and was confident that Needles could at least buy him the time he needed. Their fight would be much more physical than his, and as such less controllable in terms of proximity. A defense would be needed regardless. The time to create such a defense was what Needles was buying, to close himself off from the outside world, a symbol of his childhood defense mechanisms. Only now he has the choice. Threads escaped from Alexander's bag, slithering along the ground as though snakes or centipedes or other worm-like creatures might. These were strong Nen-infused materials, created with Alexander's own talents, strong enough to pierce flesh and tear an entire body into shreds that could then be used as threads for further use. A corpse no longer, the victim would be indistinguishable from the very thing that killed them. Alexander was an efficient killer. Needles was even more efficient and far more ruthless. As Alexander killed quickly, Needles killed painfully. Shen stayed low to the ground, ready at any moment to use his cocked momentum and punts, extending his legs to push the very planet away from himself using all of his muscular potential. It was important to stay low to keep the ability to launch himself as a perpetual inevitability, low enough to be a small target as well, and contain enough movement to have complete control over direction. Behind Needles, who floated at all times in between Shen and Alexander, a wall of thread began forming. It surrounded the chef and the tailor. Shen, realizing Candy would be trapped inside even if she broke free, attacked. With a swipe of the massive paw, he struck Needles at a spot where a pointed protertion would not be present to make the attack too pyrrhic to avoid any regret or further hindrance in the battle. Not being attached to the ground, Needles was easily moved, but took little damage, if any. After pushing the metallic creature aside, Shen bit and slashed at the wall, but despite appearances, was far too solid to damage and retained enough flexibility to avoid the forces of blunt strikes by absorbing the hit instead of tolerating it. Needles used a speedy maneuver to plant one of his spiked arms into Shen's side, hurting him and sending him away, partially in retreat for the moment. It pierced the fur but did not go any further, as Shen's combat form was built for such uses. The fur and flesh were far more durable than a regular beast's. Inside the now secluded arena, Candy wiggled and strained, but nothing helped. Alexander made no other attempts to harm her. With this clear to Candy, her mind was not panicked, but remained calm. This helped her think through the situation.
"It seems as though my clothes are being controlled,"
she thought.
"If I strip down, I should be free, but then he could see my body uncovered. I'd be cold and embarrassed. At least these walls would block the views of everyone else. That's it."
She inhaled deeply, and before she exhaled, roared like a beast.
"Someone! Anyone! Come help me!"
The voice was heard, but many were confused. Lahara was with Zero, watching Gaia slowly heal the sniper of his various wounds. They tried making sense of what they saw as they turned their attention towards Shen fighting Needles beside a walled-off area of the field. There was another who did not hear, for wind was passing over his ears too quickly. Xaxa flew in. He did not need to hear her cry, as he was already en route. Blood dripping down into a trail that shadowed his flight, he flew straight into Needles, grabbing onto him with both hands. The two flew off to the side before careening down into the ground and tumbling, Xaxa punctured in numerous spots by the creature's body. When the two came to a rest, as if it could be called that, the cannibal wrestled with the sharp being in the dirt. Shanaga lurked over to them, unsure of how to proceed. Should he help defeat Needles? Or should he take this moment to make more attempts at saving Candy? Xaxa had thought of this before he arrived. Rather than decide how to help either one, he figured this was the best method to help both Shanaga and Candy. Besides, with Needles being a rather unknown figure and Candy being walled off, he didn't see many other options. Shen left them to tussle it out on the ground. Candy was the one he wanted to save.
"The other one, Cern, was going to kill one of the others if they defeated Shivra. If I can save them, I will, but right now I need to make sure Virgil doesn't leave this area."
Law pondered how he should act. Similarly, Virgil was planning to himself how to act.
I can't let Law get to Shivra, or else there goes my ticket. I doubt anyone else was in a position to be able to take Shivra down, and the cops wouldn't just kill him. Even if I get past Law, I have to deal with them anyways. My best option is to control Law, then he can take care of the police while I get to Shivra.
The two were eyeballing each other as they thought, slowly strafing the enclosure's edges, tracing two separate semicircles. Both were waiting for the other to move, but they both knew that time was of the essence. They only had 5 minutes from the moment Baruka touched Shivra till Shivra would regain his Nen. For both of their objectives, Shivra being forced into Zetsu seemed to be the only means of completing what they set out to do. Law was finished wasting time. He extended his palm and began firing his aura-burning ability, which would put the pressure of response on Virgil, increasing his chances of making a mistake. Virgil had to dodge, and did so, not forward or backwards, but against the direction he was strafing. This placed him slightly closer to Law, who had been strafing in the same direction as him. Virgil had the reach advantage with his man-catcher, and all he'd need to do was catch Law in it. But Law was privy to this, as he'd watched his brawl with Anya. Virgil's aura was much more strained by Shivra than Law's was. Flying and manipulating his man-catcher in complex ways for so long had a clear toll. If Law could land one blast, it might take away enough aura to remove any threat Virgil could pose. Law, being more physically strained than Virgil, needed only to strip away Virgil's means of offense or escape. Virgil could just as easily escape while out of range, but Law could then make a break for Shivra and only move their fighting location to a new place. At any time, Virgil could fly off, and Law would need to act quickly in response. For the time being, letting Virgil think he has a chance at defeating Law would be the most beneficial course of action. Virgil knew that Law was an expert at tactics. He saw it in action as well. What he didn't see was Law's ability to create platforms beneath himself while in the air. Law feinted a rush towards Virgil, but stepped back to continue his attempts at slowly burning Virgil's aura away, instead of blasting it all away. Virgil reacted to Law's feint by swinging his mancatcher in his direction, which would have connected had Law not backstepped. It wouldn't have caught him, though. Because of this attack, Virgil couldn't use the mancatcher to fly himself away from Law's sweeping attack, and had to either leap back into the trees or duck. He opted to leap back, as ducking may have left him open for another Nen burning attack. He quickly moved around the enclosure, waiting for the perfect chance to strike from just the right angle. Law moved to center himself in the natural arena so that he wasn't too close to the wall of trees where Virgil's mancatcher could ensnare him.
So, you like to run and hide?
Law was attempting to cause psychological responses in Virgil, though he knew they'd have little effect. Doing this would cause a build-up over time, and revealing his calm-sounding voice would be equally as effective as what he said. Combining these two elements would cause Virgil to have a small reaction. It wouldn't affect his fighting ability, but his strategic thinking. More verbal prodding from Law would be needed to build the tension to the necessary levels. Law was hoping that by speaking to him, he could elicit a reflexive response, revealing Virgil's location. He remained silent, taking great care not to cause any noise with his movement as well. He was cloaked in his own Zetsu and practically invisible to the naked eye with his choice of velocity. Xaxa and Needles squirmed and shook. Their violent movements were mirrored by Candy's, as she recontemplated stripping out of her clothes, her body potentially catching Alexander off guard. But what if it didn't? Would Alexander be forced to use less comfortable methods to restrain her? Shen came at the wall with as much speed as he could muster, trying varying angles of strikes. He figured that no blunt attack would matter, and his only hope was to try and pierce the material by claw or tooth. The stab wounds on Xaxa's body were causing even more blood loss now, as he manipulated his severed leg to apply force to his leg wound, to reduce some of the bleeding. Needles lifted them both up and repeatedly slammed into the ground, burying the differently sized needles of his body further into Xaxa's flesh. Nothing he or Shen had done had even hurt Needles. Pain was not something he felt, ironically, as he was a manifestation of Alexander's pain. He was pain, yet felt no pain. Eventually, when Needles flew upward, Xaxa was detached. He landed away, near the trees. Needles was now free to confront Shinaga again, lest he manage to find a way through the wall of superpowered thread. Candy, before resorting to nudity, unleashed another plan. Alexander only needed to keep her there for just a bit longer. Then there would be no need for this fight. Without letting the tailor realize it, the chef began letting out her aura. She was using her ability, Spice of Life, to burn away at Alexander's senses. As his eyes were forced shut, she yelled out,
"Maximum spice!"
but in his pain, he only held on tighter with the threads now tossing around on the ground in pain. The tightness of her clothes was now too much to take off and restricted her blood circulation. She would be finding herself tired in a matter of minutes. The smell of her aura seeped out of their fighting area, where Shinaga noticed, with his strengthened senses. He fought ferociously, but each attack on Needles resulted in nothing but a movement of his body, while each attack on Shinaga resulted in adding to his weariness. The wall, despite taking hit after hit, scratch after scratch, and even a few bites, did not appear any different from when the fight began. Xaxa lay by a tree, losing mental awareness due to blood loss. He'd been trying forcing his Nen into applications he rarely exercised. It wouldn't be enough to stop all of the bleeding. Gaia was far too busy already, and too far away to assist. Awkwardly, he managed to place himself sitting up against the tree's trunk, watching the field, and all of its worried inhabitants in their own little endeavors. He'd have laughed if it wasn't so trying. He let his arm rest on the ground now to reserve his physical energy. As he did, he landed on something that felt odd. It wasn't the ground, but managed to have the dimensions nearing a tree's root while containing the softness of freshly turned dirt, like what he felt after he buried Whisk. This was something that he felt before, he realized, and he directed his attention to it. An arm, no body with it, lay underneath his weak hand. It was all that remained of the person known as Miles Lelex. Saxa thought it disrespectful to let it rot and put his remains to use in the living world. The cannibal took one bite, and then another, followed by some more, and let his limbs reattach, healing themselves. Low on blood, he'd need the food in his stomach for energy. However, the puncture wounds from Needles couldn't be healed in his way, and he sat for another moment against the tree, wondering how he could be of use to anyone.
"It's no use,"
Law shouted.
"No matter what you do, you won't win."
Virgil's response was not a linguistic one, not any auditory language at least. His response was one whose etymology was constructed from survival, and eventually, of greed. No words were spoken, only violent actions. The message was clearer than any words that could have been spoken then and there. The man-catcher exited the tree line first, heading towards Law's back as he faced away. Virgil was attached to the end of the weapon and seemingly followed its seething lead. Catching Law off guard might not have been essential, but it was only a benefit to Virgil's intentions. Both fighters were too skilled at defensive measures for the usual direct attacks to work out as planned. Attacking from behind is a solid strategic move. It assumes that blind spots are solely relying on vision, though. If Virgil hadn't disguised himself so well, Law might have heard him and reacted accordingly. But this was not the case, and Virgil was not heard nor seen by Law.
So then,
Virgil thought,
how did he know to turn around?
Law knew exactly what Virgil would try, as it was the best strategy, and his experience corroborated this. The thing about that is that when everyone knows the best strategy, it becomes expected, and in some cases countered. Law placed himself in the middle of the enclosure so as to have enough room to respond from any direction. Relying on his senses from the front, he could drop his aura that was used for defensive purposes. Virgil had no ranged attacks, so this would not be a problem. Then, Law merely needed to wait for the moment when Virgil would strike, which he knew would be from behind. Since he expected to be attacked from what was perceived as his blind spot, Law emitted aura, using N in a particular shape, behind him covering what his eyes could not see. The irony was that in effect he was more aware of what was happening behind him than what he could see in the front. Virgil would not be exiting the cover of the trees unless to attack, he predicted, so he limited the range of his N to the very edge of the tree line. The result was a method to sense an incoming attack as it happened. Virgil could feel the N as he moved through it, but as Law had planned, the attack was already underway, and it was too late for Virgil to rectify this development. Though he had the best approach in this context to attack, Law used that to his advantage, and simply allowed Virgil to fall into his trap. All of this was done despite being low on aura as well. Virgil didn't expect any judicial use of Nen in his current state, but failed to realize what might be happening when Law concealed most of his aura. With a steady spin, Law moved himself out of the way of the incoming attack and grabbed the man-catcher, Virgil still in the air holding on to it. The rest was a matter of physics. With Law grounded, he swung Virgil harshly to continue his momentum past the center of the enclosure. The force of the movement was too much for Virgil to keep his grip on the weapon, and he was sent flying toward the trees on the opposite side of where he attacked from. There, Law stood, man-catcher in hand, facing down Virgil as he rose to his feet. Neither considered attacking in this moment for different reasons. What was made clear to Virgil is that Law was not fighting to outright kill him. He was fighting to incapacitate. In a sense, Virgil was, since he required the man-catcher in order to complete his plans. For a moment he contemplated a false surrender to catch Law off guard. That was when he realized something he could do that could not be guarded from. Using his fly ability, he made the man-catcher fly straight into the sky, taking Law with it. Law decided not to let go, else Virgil would get his weapon back. At the very least, if Law stayed on, Virgil would not be able to capture anyone for his other ability. He decided he would remain holding onto the weapon indefinitely, or at least for a few minutes longer.
You ready for the rodeo?
Virgil yelled up to him. Law did not reply, only hung on as tightly as he could while the man-catcher performed dips and spirals and flips, gathering speed and then halting, rapidly shaking and then jarring forth. Virgil was getting angry. Law must have focused all of his remaining aura into his hands to hold on with impossible strength. The Tour de Blance was having an effect on his mind, though, and his brain was rattling against his skull. Time was of the essence, though, and Virgil could not wait as long as he'd have to for Law to pass out or let go of his own free will with a headache distracting him.
How about this, cowboy?
Virgil cheerily postulated.
I'm going to ram that thing down into the ground, like a rod raining down from the clouds, and it is going to pierce through it like any bullet might do to a soft body. But you, on the other hand...
He refrained from continuing, letting the insinuation hit Law. Whether he let go or not, at this point, didn't matter. He'd die if he hit the ground at high speeds, and Virgil would get the weapon back either way. The man-catcher began rocketing into the ground, ready for a quiet thud for its inevitable landfall. Law's blurry mind was racing. Without a choice, Law let go of the weapon and began his own free fall. Able to now control his own movements, he tried his best to slow the rate of his descent. Virgil considered turning the weapon back around to assault Law as he fell, but he figured he might be able to use that to his advantage. Besides, a fall from that height was enough to kill. Without wasting another minute, Virgil began flying the man-catcher back to himself to be able to make his escape from Law. Nothing else was needed for the victory, and time was running out. The man-catcher flew through the air after a quick change in course. Law remained in a controlled fall, devising any possible outcomes other than death. Virgil was reunited with his deadly vehicle of escape. He took off diagonally away from the ground in the direction of the island's edge. Law merely watched, unable to do much else in his current situation. Then, Law used his Hatsu, Aura Jump, to create a sloped surface beneath his feet, which allowed him to slow himself by sliding down it without harm. Then, as soon as he left contact with the platform, he created another platform, this time angled in a more horizontal manner. With a crouching of his legs, he landed on it and ceased almost all movement before quickly rebounding off of it, this time with complete control of direction. The entire maneuver barely took more than 3 seconds to pull off, and with it, Law changed from a fall to an upward flight. Virgil was still flying out of the enclosure as Law completed this. The platform was angled just right so that Law was able to jump straight in the path of Virgil as he ascended without noticing Law. With Virgil approaching rapidly from just feet away, Law rotated his body with a kick that connected across Virgil's chest and sent him plummeting back downward, this time without his means of escape or defense. He crashed into branch after branch as he sank below the canopy of the forest. He came to a stop as he grabbed a rather large branch, so large it might have been considered another trunk, and seemed to be causing it a discomforting posture. It could have been a structural liability. Regardless of its own contribution to the matter, Law came crashing down, foot first, into Virgil, and the branch he was holding. The force of his fall focused onto his own attack was enough to break the tree's limb off, bringing Virgil to the ground with it. The man-catcher had continued with its momentum outward and slowly arched back down, landing far away. Virgil lay, beaten, on the ground, cold with the shade's protection from the sun. Law kept a close distance, far enough to avoid a rabid attack from a cornered foe, yet close enough to be able to perform a deciding strike. Blound sat up, beaten sore from his toss through the woods. He felt lucky for having not hit any trees head-on and had only been scraped and bounced about. Quickly he remembered that he hadn't taken this trip solo. He got up, dusted himself off, and limped around looking for Maxwell. Not a minute later, he was out of the forest and walking across the fields to share his findings with the rest of the people nearby. Gaia was almost done healing the sniper, and Zero was preoccupied with his own fascination of the process. Lahara was preoccupied with something entirely different, if not the exact opposite of what Zero was witnessing. She, in her dress, had heard the voice that came from the thread-blocked arena. From her distance, she could hardly discern what was happening concerning Shen, Needles, and Xaxa, let alone decipher what was going on within the mysterious structure where the voice had emanated. Upon a hunch, she moved toward it. As Lahara had left, Blound was trying to join them. He needed Gaia. He had found Maxwell. Maxwell was alive, but not for long. Life was slipping, death growing nearer.
We must be getting close now,
Gorik whispered to Kasumi, just in case they were close enough for Shivra to hear them.
Gorik?
She sounded strained.
Yes?
I'm almost at my limit.
The toll of all the actions Gaia and Achilles had taken were reaching her now.
We'll have this all settled soon enough.
He knew she hadn't seen. Gaia had, and Gorik did too. Achilles was no more. Not only that, but the debt was so offensive and horrid that the details of which might best be reserved for those not too attached. Kasumi had a hunch. She noticed fluctuations in aura usage, spikes and valleys.
Once we have him, do you think we'll be able to get him to the Nen prison?
Gorik sounded falsely confident.
I think when we have him, we can manage. The hardest part is going to be making our appeal to the Nen courts.
Are we supposed to be the ones to do this?
The Nen courts referred to a secretive judicial process involving specially trained Nen users, operating outside of most governments, with far-back ties to the Hunter Association. While most governments avoided any interaction with the Hunter Association, the Nen courts could be called upon by civilians, often without any government knowledge of the matter. Their purpose was to navigate the law under the assumption of the existence of Nen, which changed the basic premises of everything under normal law. However, due to the nature of Nen, they needed to remain secret. As such, there are always cases which would require a Nen court to oversee that never reach that point, and people can become wrongly committed of crimes. Something as simple as contacting them proved to be difficult, even when you knew of the existence of such a thing.
Gorik, I'm running out of energy.
She gripped her conjured rifle.
I think Gaia and Achilles have done plenty. You shouldn't push yourself too hard. You'll need whatever you can muster.
This wasn't pleasing to her.
But we don't know the situation out there.
Eventually, she agreed to Gorik's suggestion and let go of her other abilities, calling them back. Blound reached Zero and the sniper, who was weary but otherwise healthy. Gaia had faded away. Bewildered, Blound frantically checked behind Zero and himself. He made sure to take a look at anywhere that was out of view.
Where's the lady with the breasts?
Zero smirked.
Who? You mean the healer?
Yeah. Where'd she go? Maxwell needs help.
He glanced around, trying to help Blound and by extension Maxwell.
I guess she's done.
The two paused, wondering how and why. Blound grew pale.
You don't think...
Those two seem tough. I don't know them that well. But those cops seem pretty certain that they could handle him.
People as accomplished as Gorik and Kasumi made Blound feel insignificant. To think that they might have been killed just now irked him. First the chief and now them. Zero was thinking over what Blound said.
You said Maxwell was hurt?
He was remembering his brief interactions with Maxwell, walking through Fisher's paradise.
I don't know if he'll make it.
Take me to him.
Zero and Blound left the sniper to recollect himself. With the sun beating on him, he stood up, no one else around him. Confused as to what had recently happened, he sat back down and enjoyed the fact that he was all right for the time being. Using compass to the truth, Gorik asked,
Where is the person with the name Shivra Njarl?
The ability could only work within a 2-mile radius, so Gorik needed to be within reasonable distance to use it. Shivra, without Nen, couldn't have made it more than that distance with the amount of time that had gone by. As the compass pointed, he began figuring the amount of time that they had left. Kasumi was simultaneously doing the same.
We must have been in this forest for a minute or two already.
I'd say closer to 2. Might as well overestimate in this situation.
He resumed his thought.
From the moment Baruka touched Shivra to the moment when everyone made it to the woods, I'd say about 15 to 30 seconds at most. If we take all of that into account.
We only have half of the time left. We should move as though we only have 2 minutes left in total, though.
She finished what he was saying as she realized the answer. Without another word, they both began following the direction the compass was pointing in. They made sure to be as quiet as possible as they hurried between the trees, As they followed, the arrow lazily turned to one side. Either Shivra had been moving or they were close enough to change their relative orientation. As they continued, the smell of salt water grew and grew. Eventually, the movements of the arrow were more frantic and jumpy. They were now close enough for Shivra's movements to register without a drastic shift in positioning. The two of them slowly exited the tree line as they approached the edge of a cliff. The horizon was in view for the first time in a while, reminding them of how small the island truly was. They looked around in the direction of the compass, but no one else was present at the cliff's edge. Shivra was somewhere directly in front of them, where there was no cover, yet they could not see him. Gorik closed the compass. It had been open for 1 minute and 37 seconds. Kasumi walked to the edge. She had the same thought as Gorik. Just below them was a small ledge wide enough to walk on. This must have been something only a few locals knew of. Kasumi started first, climbing down the cliffside. Gorik followed. Shivra was still not in view, but this had to be where he was. Anyone who had fallen into the water from this height would have died or been knocked unconscious and drowned. Even if not, they would be beaten against the rocks by the merciless waves. Shivra, in his current state, could not have survived a fall. The two made careful progress down onto the ledge. They walked out and to the side to see. Immediately, acting on instinct, they both drew their weapons. Gorik pulled out his pistol while Kasumi crouched with her rifle. They had found Shivra. Cern waited up top for the results of this encounter to determine his next target. Shivra Niarl, with nowhere else to go to, turned to face those pointing guns at him, squarely, defiantly.
Shivra, you're coming with us!
Gorik yelled at him. He shook his head.
No.
Don't you realize what you've done?
Kasumi automatically took a more compassionate tone.
Now we have to do this.
Are you going to kill me?
Gorik and Kasumi were silent.
If you leave us, no choice.
Gorik wasn't sure what Shivra's reaction would be.
But why? They all tried to kill me, so I killed them. It was self-defense.
Kasumi waited as Gorik was silent, then spoke calmly.
You've hurt many people.
They tried to hurt me first.
Not all of them. There are those who you've hurt first.
She wanted to make him understand.
I just wanted to survive. Why can't I do that?
Kasumi was getting more worried.
If you stay here, more people will get hurt. By staying here, you are hurting others. You are causing this.
Gorik was trying to keep track of the time. He wasn't sure how long they had taken to climb down, but the conversation was taking too long. He didn't want Kasumi to be in danger.
Don't leave us with no choice here.
Shivra thought for a moment.
I see.
There was a longer pause which made both Kasumi and Gorik uneasy.
I will have to be the one to settle this.
As Shivra stepped forward, a bullet ripped out of a gun. It flew with remarkable vindication, right at Shivra. He did nothing but stand there. There was little wind. As the waves crashed and subsided, came and drew back out. The wind followed a similar pattern of furiosity and calm. At this moment, the wind happened to be in one of the innumerable lulls. Just sure as it would return to this state, the wind would come back, increasing in strength and then quiet again, like a rocking boat or the peaks and troughs of waveforms and terrain. Mist splashed about and made the breeze feel cooler than it was. The bullet came to Shivra. He didn't flinch or acknowledge its existence as it neared his forehead. With a few centimeters left for its voyage into the man's skull, the bullet was stopped momentarily by an invisible presence. As this sight registered in the minds of all that saw, the round was sent off, out into the ocean. The 5 minutes was up. No more shots were fired. They'd do no good. Gorik and Kasumi only remained still, wondering how close they might have been. If only they didn't try convincing him, they both thought. Shivra did not smile or show any emotion. He stepped toward them one more time. Both Gorik and Kasumi attempted to devise ways to keep the other safe, even if it meant sacrificing themselves.
This is how things are,
Shivra said to them. He turned away from them and faced the ocean. All three of them looked out at the water, taking note of where it met the sky, the clouds above, and their shadows below. Kasumi knew, Gorik knew, even Shivra knew, they were dead. Cern now leaned far enough over the edge to risk falling down with them. He wanted to see what would happen. Shivra crouched down.
You might want to step back.
His legs extended with extreme speed. His body was launched out over the ocean like hot lead out of the barrel of a weapon. The force of his jump cracked the cliff behind him, causing it to crumble downward, pieces falling into the ocean. Amidst this chaos, Gorik and Kasumi struggled to not fall in themselves. They managed to make it partially back up the cliff when they lost all momentum and began falling back down. But they didn't fall. They were caught. Cern had grabbed them after jumping down, planting his knife into the cliff so that he wouldn't also fall himself. The man who had planned on killing one of them now had saved them both. The three of them rested on the newly drawn edge of the cliff, much closer to the trees than before, as Shivra grew smaller and smaller in the sky. If Rafa G and Sony Ishikawa had investigated more thoroughly, they would have noticed a similarly shaped crater on the mainland, facing Cowtip Island. If they had noticed this, they might have figured out that Shivra did not swim. He had jumped through the storm and landed in the water near the island. It wouldn't have made much of a difference, but it had the slight possibility of the group discerning that Shivra, in fact, could not swim. His mother had been too sick to ever teach him. Shivra soared beneath the clouds. Unlike before, when he was propelled almost perfectly vertically, he was now flying across the sea horizontally, away from the island. After a while, he stopped himself mid-air with wings made of Nen. Then he faced the surface, its reflection of the sun momentarily blinding him. Just as Cern did in his battle with Zero, Shivra exerted aura out of his feet, which were now above the rest of his body. He plunged down, not into soil this time, but into the vast surface of the ocean. There was hardly a splash at all. Something about the stream of bubbles that followed him down managed to repel sea-dwelling animals away in all directions. Down and down he continued, his momentum fading and reigniting by his own actions. He swam further and then more. The bubbles were all gone now. From a far-off distance it looked like a tiny speck climbing down through a gradient of blues with greenish hues, growing darker as it descended, whose lightest color was only separated by the near mirror image of the sky by a seemingly arbitrary line, shaking with the winds and movements of the water itself. This border was only recognizable as the home of drifting seaweed and whatever foam remained from the crashing of waves around. The person, barely recognizable as such from this distance, just made its way further down, down into the dark. After some time, as pressure built up around him, Shivra's body began absorbing the rest of the oxygen stored within him. His mind wasn't thinking the same as before. All he could think was that it got colder and colder as he arrived in the dark. Throughout the dark was nothing his eye could see except specks of various random materials, water-residing dust. His eyes did begin to make out something, as his lungs just began their struggle for more life. Stars. His oxygen-deprived brain and sensory-deprived eyes could make out hundreds, thousands of them. Just as the moment after he reached the highest elevation of his lifetime, a similarly hard-to-breathe environment, he saw them again. But there was just one thought on his mind. How comfortable it was above ground, yet below clouds. The stars would never be his home. They were too uncomfortable. The further he strayed from home, the colder it became, no matter which direction. Distraught, he turned around to witness the dim light of the sun through the ocean's lens. From far off, a fish, merely a week away from being caught and having its parts separated to be cooked, half-masticated, and then discarded by humans too busy enjoying the luxury of their wealth, watched this curious person turn around. The doomed fish saw, unfathomably, as this tiny speck of sea dust thrashed and flailed about, struggling for something. But it was too deep and too hindered by a lack of resources to make any meaningful movements other than a desperate spasm. Surrounded by a gradient of blues, mostly dark now, the speck stopped moving, and the fish swam on for another day. Perhaps it was a chemical release from his brain that had induced such a euphoric sensation that he simply stopped moving as the sunlight above faded away forever. Or perhaps it was a final thrust and a sensation of terror as the lights were shut out on someone by surprise, their vision and other senses too clouded with deprivation and suffering to continue on. Either one was felt by Anya, who remained silent as she felt this cocktail of emotions. No one asked. But if they had, she would have remained silent on the matter. There was no reason to speak on it, not to her. There was no reason to hear it, not to anyone else around her. Finally, there was no reason to struggle anymore. For anyone, in this moment, on this island. Virgil and Dread Law paused their conflict, Enormous sounds, cracks, rumblings, and the vibrations that accompanied them all had indicated one thing to them. The 5 minutes was up.
Ha! You didn't get to kill Shivra! I've kept you from your plans!
Shouted Virgil as he remained on the ground.
No. He could be dead.
But you didn't defeat him!
Oh, but I did. My goal was never for me to be the one to defeat him. It was for my plan to have defeated him. I was just preventing you from stopping that. In doing so, you have failed your plan.
Virgil, annoyed.
So what now?
Dreadlaw, relieved.
My plan didn't have any need for you to die.
Dreadlaw left Virgil to figure out what to do with himself. He wanted to verify whether or not the plan really had been successful. There was no further reason for them to continue fighting. Lahara came upon the threaded wall and ceased any further motion. Shanaga had been dodging any stabs attempted by Needles, but was getting tired. Xaxa came sprinting in, tackling Needles.
Shen, I will be the buffer.
He rammed Needles into the threaded wall.
He's the nail and you are the hammer. With me here, you will be protected from his body.
Xaxa had formulated for Shanaga to slam into his body with great strength, with Xaxa absorbing the spikes and forcing Needles into the threaded wall in order to tear through it. Inside, Candy was fumbling for her knife with the limited movement she was allotted. Alexander was still coughing from the spice. Lahara had had enough.
Stop it, you idiots! We're all on the same side! How can you squabble like this?
No one answered. It took a minute for the fighting to die down. Xaxa was still eager to try his plan at taking down the wall. Shanaga only listened to Lahara because he thought she must have been around the same age as Candy. Alexander, having recognized her voice, let Candy loose within the confines of their arena. Needles was not happy she was here. He thought that if she were to interrupt, it could cost Alexander's life, and if needed, he'd remove her from the situation. Alexander coughed out,
Lahara, I can't let this girl go! To kill Shivra!
Didn't you realize? The time's up. Either Shivra's dead or it's too late. There's no point in this fight anymore.
She was as diplomatic as always. Her comment meant that there was no need for Alexander to explain why. Xaxa filled in the blanks with his own reasoning. He knew that Whisk would not want to see her as a killer. Since he was dead, Xaxa would ignore that thought as usual. But seeing as how Shanaga retains Whisk's personality to some extent, he figured it would pain Shen to see her as a killer, and this he could not allow. Candy did not know what to do next.
You mean it's done?
She asked weakly.
Yes, you don't have to worry anymore.
Lahara confirmed. The threaded wall came down, leaving Candy standing there.
So then, I failed.
Alexander then stood.
No.
He coughed some more.
You were critical. In taking Shivra down, you did everything you could.
But Candy still felt empty, like she had failed Whisk in some way.
I couldn't do anything.
Shen walked over to Candy and nuzzled her arm. He turned back to normal and laid on her foot. She crouched down to pet him. A ways away, Tulva and Anya had exited the woods, where they had taken cover, to find Baruka's body. When Shivra had regained his defensive orb, Baruka had fallen unconscious in that moment.
Oh, Baruka.
Tulva leaned down to make sure he was alive.
You and Miles did a great service to the island. Don't worry.
No one was sure how long he'd be asleep this time, but they knew it would be considerably longer than when he had enacted his power on Bertha, which left him out for a few days. Tulva was now letting the impact of what had happened hit him. Miles was dead. Baruka was in a coma. Even Maxwell was dead, for all he knew. He no longer had the group that he had become so close with. His friends had paid a much steeper price than he. Anya stopped and watched him. She had been feeling everyone's fears and horror throughout. At times, it had almost been too much for her to handle. She had come along to see what fear had felt like to someone so powerful. She knew that it would traumatize her greatly, but that it would be a necessary cost to pay for such a weapon. But she regretted her decision. These fears in this battle, it had been emotional, stressful, and taxing on her own mind. She felt like it was unethical to then turn this against others, after having felt such strong, empathetic connections with so many people at once, feeling deaths, pain, and suffering. The most shocking thing of all was Shivra's fear. She had expected it to be great, in order to frighten even the most powerful of people, but it had a lasting impact on her. It wasn't any different. It was the same as any fear a child might feel. Just a regular person. This whole time she had thought of him as a monster, which required a new kind of fear that would be so potent it would be unbearable. But instead, it was just the same fears everyone else feels. Just another scared individual.
Something positive had to come of this,
she thought. Unless she made a positive out of it, she would not find one. So she decided to learn from it all, to adapt and grow. She altered her hatsu. From now on, she'd expand her ability to incorporate a full spectrum of emotion. This way, she could make deeper connections and have a greater understanding of those around her, and in turn, could bestow them with emotions to help or empower allies, if need be. Anya no longer wanted to remain primarily in the negative side of emotions. She wanted it all, as life is not discriminant. Just like on the island, there would be all emotions. From now on, she'd be able to share them just as easily as she would be able to feel them. At this time, she may have been one of the only ones not on the cliff to know that Shivra Njal was dead. Soon, the survivors would learn of his fate as well. However, it is what they do after learning it that is what defines them.